The U.S. is towing the line between not escalating the conflict and retaliating for strikes against American bases and Western interests in the Middle East.
We're not at war with the Houthis. We're not seeking to go to war with the Houthis. But if they continue the attacks, we will continue to disrupt and degrade their capabilities.
Plus, there is a pacifist trying to unseat Vladimir Putin in upcoming elections. We get an update from Moscow on his chances.
His candidacy could quickly disappear. The Russian Central Election Commission says 15% of signatures among the more than 100,000 that the candidate presented to endorse his candidacy are invalid.
And later, it's been 1 year since devastating earthquakes in Syria and Turkey, and we take a look at the civil war in Sudan. Today is Tuesday, February 6th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken landed in Cairo for his meeting with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi as the United States works to advance a plan for a truce in Gaza and hostage deal mediated by the Egyptians and Qataris. Blinken departed Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, shortly after sunrise for what is set to be a busy day visiting Egypt and Qatar before flying to Israel to discuss hostage negotiations, post-war Gaza plans, and the prospect of Arab countries and Israel normalizing ties. That's a move that was underway before the October 7th Hamas attacks. It's Blinken's fifth trip to the region since October, and it comes as the United States presses ahead with its retaliatory campaign against Iran-aligned militants, which had attacked and killed U.S. troops in a military outpost in Jordan. And in a breaking development, the diplomacy is proceeding. Tuesday afternoon in Gaza, a representative of Hamas said that a short while ago, the Hamas movement delivered its response to the framework agreement to the brothers in Qatar and Egypt, the statement said, referring to a comprehensive and full ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he would bring that response from Hamas to Israel on Wednesday and called it essential to move ahead. There's still a lot of work to be done, he said. But we continue to believe that an agreement is possible and indeed essential, and we will continue to work relentlessly to achieve it, Blinken told reporters in Doha on Tuesday. Also Tuesday, as Secretary Blinken is pushing for de-escalation, Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen fired missiles at two commercial vessels in the Red Sea, causing minor damage to one of them. So far, though, Iran-backed militants in the Middle East have not been deterred by U.S. strikes in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb gets us up to speed on the latest tit-for-tat in the Middle East.
B-1 bombers flying from the United States to hit 85 Iranian-backed militant targets in Iraq and Syria on Friday in response to the killing of three U.S. service members last week. Major General Pat Ryder is the Pentagon press secretary.
Our responses are not complete. Again, I'm not going to telegraph or discuss what that may be, other than we'll conduct that at a time and place of our choosing.
A day later, the U.S. and the U.K. struck 36 Iranian-backed Houthi targets in Yemen. But Iranian proxies in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen did not appear to get the message. Iran-backed militants attacked U.S. and partner forces in Syria three times since Friday. An attack near mission support site Green Village killed six Syrian Democratic Force partners. The U.S. also destroyed more anti-ship missiles in Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen that were ready to launch into international shipping lanes after the U.S. and U.K. strikes. Major General Pat Ryder.
We're not at war with the Houthis. We're not seeking to go to war with the Houthis. But if they continue the attacks, we will continue to disrupt and degrade their capabilities.
In addition to more attacks from Iran proxies, the U.S. is now taking heat from Iraqi officials who were not notified before the attacks and who say civilians were killed during the U.S. strikes that occurred on their soil.
Iraq, like every country in the region, understood that there would be a response after the deaths of our soldiers. As for this specific response on Friday, there was not a pre-notification. We informed the Iraqis immediately after the strikes occurred.
The Pentagon says it is still assessing the casualties from the military strikes over the weekend. To date, U.S. forces have been attacked about 170 times in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan since mid-October. while the Houthis have launched more than 30 attacks against international shipping lanes in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
On to Ukraine now. The EU's Josep Borrell arrived in Kyiv to discuss support for Ukraine and Kyiv's reform progress. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces confirmed a new special operation in the Black Sea. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
The head of EU diplomacy, Josep Borrell, arrived in Kyiv on Tuesday. This is his fourth visit since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion. Borrell said he will discuss support for Ukraine from the EU on both the military and financial sides, such as Ukraine Facility Program, and Kyiv's progress on its reform path on the way to the EU. Borrell's visit is happening just a week since the European Union approved a four-year 50 billion euro, which is $54 billion, financial support for Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue the shelling across Ukraine. A two-month-old baby boy was killed as a result of a Russian strike on the city of Zolochiv in the Kharkiv region. His body was found under the rubble of a destroyed hotel, local authorities confirmed. Three women, including the boy's mother, survived. They were taken to the hospital with injuries. Ukrainian special forces continue to conduct operations in the Black Sea. A Russian radar station and equipment that helped the Russian army to conduct UAV attacks on the south regions of Ukraine were destroyed. And finally, as Ukraine is soon to enter the third year of full-scale Russian invasion, the Ukrainian parliament approved the decree of President Volodymyr Zelensky on the extension of martial law and mobilization of troops until May 13, 2024. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And as all that's happening in Ukraine, Russia is preparing for a presidential election next month. It's an election overshadowed by the country's invasion of Ukraine and a crackdown on political opponents and the media. So what does that mean for a pacifist who's trying to unseat Vladimir Putin? Marcus Harton narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
Boris Nadezhdin is the hope of pacifist voters in Russia, the only electoral candidate whose platform includes a proposal for immediate peace talks with Kyiv. But his candidacy could quickly disappear. The Russian Central Election Commission says 15% of signatures among the more than 100,000 that the candidate presented to endorse his candidacy are invalid. For some independent observers, this is a political decision aimed at preventing incumbent President Vladimir Putin from having to face a pacifist. Dmitry Potapenko is an economist and political analyst. He says the election committee is just a technical mechanism. He says a decision will be made by completely different parts of the leadership. He calls Russia a feudal state governed by the lieutenant generals and says Vladimir Putin does not have to take part in any elections. Nadezhdin is running as the candidate of the 10-year-old center-right Civic Initiative Party. His campaign team is well aware that there is a high chance he will be removed from the electoral race, but he is confident he has popular support. He says it's impossible to prevent a person who has collected hundreds of thousands of signatures from taking part in elections. Nadezhdin says he will appeal, but if he's ultimately out of the race, Vladimir Putin will not have to face any candidate who questions his vision of the war. With political figures such as opponents Alexei Navalny or Sergei Uldatsov behind bars, only the liberal Yabloko party was officially opposed to the so-called special military operation, but the party has decided not to take part in this poll. Its chairman is Nikolai Rybakov. He says that for 30 years and longer, people were, in effect, told their choices didn't matter, and election results were known in advance. He says the message was, your voice means nothing. You can do nothing. All politicians are the same. Vladimir Putin's most likely opponents will be the Communist Party and the ultra-nationalist Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, both of which support the invasion of Ukraine. The Just Russia for Truth Party did not present a candidate and endorsed Putin. Its slogan, "For a Great Country, for Putin." With the campaign dominated by the war in Ukraine, Russians will be called to the poll with practically two options: vote for war or not vote at all. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Devastating floods hit the Sunshine State and America's second biggest city. But first, the civil war in Sudan has become a massive humanitarian crisis and risks becoming a famine. My next guest argues that the conflict is bigger than Sudan itself and has become a vortex of transnational conflicts. I'm joined by Alex DeWall. He writes extensively about Sudan and North Africa, and he's executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University.
There was this wonderful civic uprising with the citizens on the streets, many of them women, which then led to a coexistence, cohabitation between the military and the civilians. And the military having been in power for 30 years, and of course they didn't want to relinquish that. And in 2021, the two generals who were the sort of the dual heads of the junta took power in a coup. They dismissed the civilians. But those two generals couldn't agree. And so 10 months ago, that disagreement flared into outright fighting in the capital, Khartoum, and Sudan has been plunged into war ever since.
The conflict, it seems, though, is bigger than just this one country. You describe it as a vortex of transnational conflicts. How does this small, relatively small country's civil war affect the entire region?
So each of the two protagonists has transnational links and foreign sponsors. And at the beginning of the conflict, those could have been contained. So what happened was this: the one who was most proactive was the head of the paramilitary forces, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti. He is the heir of the infamous Janjaweed. He has been recruiting from neighboring countries, including Chad and Niger. He's been deploying his forces as mercenaries in Libya and in Central African Republic, in partnership with Russia's Wagner Group. And he's been backed by the United Arab Emirates, which sees him as a capable, ruthless future leader that can be part of a constellation of states backed by Abu Dhabi. On the other side, you have General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, head of the regular army, and his patron has been Egypt, but he's also backed by many Islamists from the former regime. And they have their patrons in Qatar and Turkey, also in Iran. And as the rapid support forces have been gaining momentum, and they have themselves been rearming. And meanwhile, in next door Ethiopia, there's a parallel conflict emerging because the government of Ethiopia, headed by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, is definitely fully in the orbit of the United Arab Emirates, whereas his adversaries that include the state of Eritrea to the north, some of the rebels in different parts of the country, and Somalia are in the other camp, or in the Egyptian camp. So what we see is these two storms, this very active, very violent storm in Sudan, converging with the brewing conflict in between Ethiopia and its neighbors into one huge maelstrom.
So what needs to happen for this to quiet down?
Well, the road to peace through for Sudan, indeed for the Horn of Africa as a whole, runs through the Middle East. It is the main sponsors of this are in the first instance Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, but also Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar as well as sort of secondary players. So they need to get together. Now, the problem that's been facing the United States is that each of these conflicts, and particularly the Sudan one, has been handled exclusively by the Africa Bureau. Essentially, the National Security Council and the president have said, we have enough on our plate. Don't bother us with these African conflicts. You know, the Africa Bureau should sort it out. The problem being that the Africa Bureau staff officials, Assistant Secretary Molly Fee, she might carry a lot of weight in, let's say, Kenya or Uganda. Not so when she goes to Cairo or to Abu Dhabi. So it needs a much higher level of engagement from the United States in order to get the key funders, patrons in this war, Egypt and the Emirates, that are both U.S. allies, get them to agree on stopping the war. And that's not happening.
Alex DeWall is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. Hundreds of Haitians took to the streets on Monday to protest the unelected government of Prime Minister Ariel Henry, whose administration has seen alliances of violent gangs expand control across most of the capital and spread to nearby areas. A power vacuum after Haiti's last president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated allowed gangs to rise up. Local residents, caught in clashes between the two major gang alliances, police and vigilantes, often face indiscriminate killing, rampant sexual violence, looting, and other acts of violence. One man told Reuters that people have had enough.
It's been 3 years since former Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. Prime Minister Ariel Henry is the head of the government. He has done absolutely nothing for the population. Insecurity is everywhere, the roads are destroyed, and no one can go on with their daily life. We are not here today to wage a war against Ariel Henry, to replace him with someone else. We're here today to wage war against the system. This time it is a battle for us, for the Haitian people.
The UN says nearly half of Haiti's population is going hungry as the conflict prevents food and aid from moving across the country, and some 300,000 people are internally displaced due to the violence. This according to the head of Human Rights Watch. Tuesday marks the one-year anniversary of devastating earthquakes that rocked Syria and Turkey, killing 56,000 people. VOA's Heather Murdoch is based in Istanbul, and she has a look at recovery efforts. Most people in northwest Syria were already displaced from years of civil war when the earthquake struck. A year later, emergency aid has dried up, and some people are sheltering in condemned buildings. Heather Murdoch reports with Moaya Atrash in the countryside of Idlib, Syria.
When the earthquake struck last year, Aliya al-Sheikh Debs literally threw her children out of the house as the stairs crumbled and the walls cracked. Other people didn't get out fast enough, and locals say they could hear their cries from underground for days before they died. Debs' small family survived and moved into a tent, as did so many other people in this region, where most of the population has been displaced by war. She says her house is condemned, but she brings her children there despite the danger when the tent is flooded. Other families in the region were not so lucky. This is Omar Atia, a father of three who lost one son in the earthquake. He says he and his other children were pulled out of the rubble first, and by evening, when they got to his third child, the boy was dead. Last year's catastrophic earthquakes originated in Turkey, where more than 50,000 people were killed. But the tragedy spread well into Syria. Nearly 6,000 people died here from the earthquake, in one of the last areas of the country still at war, with nearly 100 civilian deaths in recent months. Health officials say a year later, the earthquake's aftermath is still diminishing their already limited ability to take care of the sick or injured. Here's Dr. Zuhair El-Karat, who heads the Idlib Health Directorate. He says after the earthquake, health facilities were damaged and the region lost doctors, nurses, and administrative workers. Basic needs, like beds and medical equipment, are also in short supply, and all kinds of humanitarian aid to the region have been severely cut in the past year. Locals say many people who were surviving on food aid are now hungry. Again, this is Alia Al-Sheikh Debs. She says when the earthquake first happened, aid workers gave her food, soap, clothes, blankets, and other items after they fled their homes with nothing. But that was only for a short time after the earthquake, and aid no longer comes. Food assistance comes sporadically now, she says, when it comes at all. Heather Murdock in Istanbul with Mawia Atrash in Idlib, Syria, VOA News.
And now to Turkey, where hundreds of thousands of people still live in containers, grieving, traumatized, and not knowing whether or when they will have new homes. Heather Murdock reports this time with Orhan Erkilic in Kahramanmaraş, Turkey.
If Hulya Adıyaman could go back in time before the February 2023 earthquake that took her apartment building and many of her neighbors and relatives, she wouldn't save her home. She says she wishes they had lost their homes in the earthquake and no people. A lost life cannot come back, she says. More than 50,000 people perished in the earthquake and millions were displaced. Many families, like Adıyaman's, stayed in tents for months before being moved into container homes, where hundreds of thousands of people still live. Earthquake experts say while the earthquake was massive, a large portion of the deaths and property loss could have been prevented. Turkey has earthquake building codes that were not always followed amid construction booms in recent decades. A. Özgün Konca of the Kandili Observatory and Earthquake Research Institute says buildings constructed after new laws were adopted should not have collapsed during the earthquake.
Another main problem is that the ones that were built after 2000 should be able to resist this earthquake. And the main problem is that some of these buildings, which some of them were quite big buildings, did not do that.
But many fell down in seconds, he says, with people inside. The government has promised to build hundreds of thousands of new homes for people, but so far, only tens of thousands have been made available. Families say they can never recover what they lost. Funduk Asku lost her daughter, her son-in-law, and their four children in the earthquake. She says that if she were offered jewels, or even all the world, she wouldn't take them if she could have her grandchildren back. That's how heavy the pain is, she says. Survivors say they also cannot forget the horrors they witnessed. Again, this is Hulya Adıyaman. She says they saw bodies lined up in rows, decomposing. She saw neighbors carried out of the rubble, dead, after they had waited for 3 days for help. Adıyaman says she hopes to move out of this container and into new, government-built housing, if or when it becomes available to her and her family. At least then, she says, they may once again feel at home. Reporting with Orhan Erkilic in Kahramanmaraş, I'm Heather Murdock, VOA News, Istanbul.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.